Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2011. Lecture 6, delivered on February 3, 2011. The title of this lecture is Essentials of Accounting for Finance.
Today, Essentials of Accounting for Finance. Now, I went through the fundamental equation of accounting, the fundamental accounting identity, discussed that and what it means in terms of the legal implications of being a corporation. Now, in this course, we will look at primarily finance of the corporation, and the more specifically, generally, finance of the public corporation, because we can get so much more information about public corporations than we can private corporations. As a matter of curiosity, I might have already asked this, how many of you are familiar with the Edgar database? Okay. I didn't think so. I'm going to show you, Edgar, I'm going to show you a couple of other places where you can get accounting information, but also get the kind of information that we use in finance, specifically ratios. We'll certainly teach you how to do ratios and ratio analysis, but I also want to show you where this information comes from. Now, from your days in accounting course, in an accounting course, and I'm assuming most, if not all of you, had your first accounting course, I'm sure you remember every detail of that course. Specifically, you learned about the importance of the financial statements, those statements that are available in a public corporation for inspection, analysis, and use by outside and internal consumers of the information, of financial information. And in finance, we are consumers of information. When we look at a financial statement, we see a product, an information product that is provided to us by the corporation, relying upon certain laws and regulations that govern what can be said, how it must be presented, and at least to some extent, we can rely upon the accuracy of that information within the context of the rules. Specifically, financial information that is available through several sources, specifically the SEC, is presented in accordance with regulations promulgated by the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC. Generally speaking, with respect to the information in financials that would be available on Form 10-K, and I'll go through that in more detail later, on Form 10-K, that information is provided to us pursuant to the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. The information is produced in accordance with generally accepted accounting standards consistently applied, and it is audited with respect to the generally accepted accounting principles of the auditor that the auditors abide by. All of that aside, financial statements. The one that you probably would think of first would be the income statement. And then there would be the balance sheet. A third statement that is important is the statement of cash flows, what we used to call the sources and uses statement. And then there is another financial statement, the statement of retained earnings. Now, these financial statements actually all dovetail. They essentially, they're in some cases, there are nothing but magnified parts. One financial statement is a magnified part of another. The balance sheet, in many ways, is the pivotal statement. Certainly, the statement of retained earnings is just a verbosity of the balance of the balance sheet. Interestingly, though, the income statement is actually just an expansion of a small part of the statement of retained earnings. So there you are. It all kind of comes back to that balance sheet. And from year to year, we can see the sources and uses of cash. I'm not going to go through that sources and uses in the detail that some finance professors might, but I do want you to understand how it works and the logic behind it. Before I do that, though, there is a fifth accounting statement, a fifth financial statement, I should say, that is hardly ever talked about in accounting and in finance classes. I've told you about the big ones, the income statement and the balance sheet, and then the statement of cash flows, and then the statement of retained earnings. There's another one out there. Did anyone know what the other financial statement is that actually is really important to us in finance and would be important to you as an investment analyst or as a good investor? Does anyone know what it would be? It's the notes to the financial statement. Was that what you were going to say? Huh? No, it's actually with respect to the notes. They tell you stories that are not anywhere else in the financial statements. They explain why something was put the way it was in the financial statements. They give you background about, well, here's what happened, and here's why this number is the way it is, or here's what happened in this situation, there was a charge. Those verbal explanations are there in the financial statement known as the notes. You can also read behind those notes, and you can know some of the things that were going on with respect to the auditor's opinion. One thing that I found quite frequently, I worked as a consultant with companies that were just coming to life. And I was always required to put this arcane language in this last financial statement, in this last note. These financial statements were prepared on the assumption that this is a going concern. That was a flag that essentially financial statements work as a reliable resource only if the company is a going concern. In other words, it will live from year to year. There is no reason to believe that it won't, no good reason to believe that it won't be around for the next set of financial statements. Whenever financial statements are put together, that going concern is behind the scenes. We assume that the corporation will continue. And if I have to say something about the assumption of going concern maybe not being a good, a reliable thing to think of in this corporation's life, that would mean that I am essentially saying that the corporation, that the financial statements themselves should be taken with a large grain of salt. Because if this corporation isn't going to survive, or if there's a good chance that this corporation won't survive, then everything I wrote in those financial statements is questionable. Not because we lied, but because financial statements are prepared on the assumption that the company's going to be around for a while longer, at least until the next round of financial statements are made. Look, I went through this simple stuff with, basically you've got the revenue of a corporation, and then you subtract the expenses, and what you get from there is your gross income. I'm sorry. Don't trust me today. I'm cold. Cost of goods sold. Then you got your gross income. Now, cost of goods sold is a concept that applies only if we are talking about certain kinds of businesses, specifically those that produce tangible products. Because cost of goods sold refers to how much it costs to get the stuff and move it from one stage of production to another, to the final stage where it is saleable. If there is not a cost of goods sold, that means that there is not a manufacturing process or something like that involved. So we might not always see a cost of goods sold line. But then we take out all the different kinds of expenses. And we will come down to the earnings before interest and taxes. Now, in these expenses, we have all kinds of different animals. We have wages and salaries. We have utilities. And we also have an animal probably coming up very, very high on the list, depreciation, which is a regular schedule for writing down the cost of something that is too large in value to write off in one period, to expense in one period. Now, you probably remember the joys of the different depreciation systems, straight line, MACRS. I don't know, do they even teach you some of your digits anymore, depreciation? Did they do? Okay, that was always my favorite. But understand this, that when you look at these expenses, you have to understand that these are the occurrence of expenses, not the incurrence of a cash flow. So in other words, in a given week, I might recognize your week's salary. But if I don't pay you until the next Friday, I don't incur a cash flow this week, a cash outflow. But I recognize that I paid you the salary, the wage expense, on my financial statement for the week. Similarly, have any of you ever, when you get your bills and it says it is due on this date, okay, do you pay it immediately? I'm sure all of you do, or not. You know, I figure, you know, what's a year or two? You know, 2011, 2012, meh. If I wait long enough, the apocalypse will come in 2012 and I won't have to worry about the nonsense. But it is when the bill is showing up that I will recognize the expense, not when I pay it. So there is going to be a disjoint between what is said on a financial statement in many regards and what actually I can recognize as an expense at the time. Okay? Depreciation. When I buy a building for $10 million, I've lost $10 million right there and then. But the depreciation will be only a part of that in every period until I have wiped out all of the costs of the building. So in other words, from a financial perspective, we would use a technical term like that. And yes, that's a technical term. We have to adjust these numbers to recognize not expenses in an accounting sense, but cash flow in a real sense. You could be a very wealthy man. In fact, you look like a wealthy man. You're just slumming it here at this university. You could be a very wealthy man, but if you don't have the money to pay your bills, then you're dead. You see, so what we care about in finance is not whether or not an expense has occurred, but whether a cash flow has occurred. You buy a product from me, and you say, can I pay you next week? And I say, oh, sure. Okay? So the revenue I have to recognize now, but the cash flow doesn't happen right away. So what I would really care about is looking at how much receivables have gone up. That would tell me, oh, well, I have to take down the revenue by the amount of the receivables. You buy something from me for $5,000. You pay me $2,000 of it now. The $3,000 goes to receivables. So when I look at the revenue, I have to say, okay, I have to knock that down by the amount that my receivables went up. My receivables went up by $3,000, so that $5,000 revenue I see on my income statement, I have to drop that down by the rise in receivables. Okay? That's what this is all about. Let me go through this, through the meat grinder. Now, we pay the interest. But again, remember that when I pay the interest, it's different from when I recognize the interest on my financial statement. The interest might, I might recognize the interest payment let's say, January the 30th. But I might not pay it until February the 15th. So there for a while, I'd have an increase in interest payable by the amount of what I recognize but haven't paid yet. And then after the interest line we deduct, we get to our earnings before taxes, EBT. Now I'm going to take out the taxes. And in this course, I will usually just do something, taxes at 30% of EBT, something like that, okay? The real world of taxes is a pain in the derriere. It is the marginal tax structure is progressive, but it also has some weird glitches. As a matter of fact, interestingly enough, the top marginal tax rate for corporations is actually lower than the tier below it. I'm still trying to figure out. They give some song and dance explanation about how it has to do with alternative minimum tax or something like that. It just doesn't make sense to me. But anyway, the calculation of marginal tax rates is just an art, and I'll probably go through that in the next class, but not here, not today. It's too cold. But in most cases, you'll just see me tax at 32% of EBT. Something like that. That's how we do it in teaching this stuff. And then we get down to the net income line. Net income. Now, in a technical sense, setting aside the issues of accounting versus finance, the net income represents what the shareholders have as a residual claim on the cash flows. You see, what happened up here is that in the income statement, I was recognizing every debtor I owed money to. All the debts have prior claim. Once I've paid them in a timely manner what they are due in the period under consideration, I then have what is available to the shareholders. Now, the shareholders can get theirs two ways. The shareholders can get a dividend. What remains will go to retained earnings. On the balance sheet. Now, I might not pay a dividend, but I could. But one way or the other, the shareholders are entitled to this money at the net income line. They can get it as dividends, some of it. What they don't get as dividends is plowed back into the corporation as retained earnings. Know this, retained earnings does not really exist. There is no such thing as a checking account called retained earnings. I have heard a surprising number of times corporate people saying, well, we'll buy this out of retained earnings. We'll pay for this project out of retained earnings. Now, I am always hopeful that they know damn well there's no such thing as a retained earnings account. There's nothing like that. It is merely a formal recognition of the claim the shareholders have after the debts have been paid and after any dividends have been paid. Now, as far as the balance sheet goes, in finance, and I don't want I know people listen to these podcasts, and I don't want them sending me, well, that's not really true. But in a real sense, it is. When we look at financial statements, we are not picking apart the and finding the anatomy of a flea. We need large pieces of information, blocks, because we know the accounting statements aren't telling us the true story anyway. So we care more about the chunks of information. And so when I do a balance sheet, you see me do it in a fairly summary fashion. On one side, you're going to have the assets. They'll be broken into the short-term assets and the long-term assets. Now, as far as short-term assets go, the big one is cash and marketable securities. And then you're going to have your accounts receivable. What money is owed you? That $3,000 would be in there as well as other things. Now there will be other items in here. The one that is the most important to me, really for the time being anyway, is inventory. Now other ones you would see in there is prepaid insurance. See, when you pay insurance, you actually pay it for a whole maybe year. And then what we do is we expense out 1 month at a time. So really we have an asset. Let's say our insurance bill is $12,000. So each month I would cut off 1,000 of that, put it into the income statement as $1,000 spend for the month. And then that would bring down the prepaid insurance from $12,000 to $11,000. Notice again how the difference between that difference between the cash flow and what's in the income statement. I'm out 12 grand. I have to pay the insurance company 12 grand right away for my insurance policy for the year. But each month I can recognize only a month's part of that in the expenses. So there's again is that disjunction between what we in finance care about, the actual money, and what the accounting statement tells us. But like I said, there are other ones that can show up in this short-term assets thing. But the biggies are cash and marketable securities, accounts receivable, and inventory. Now, long-term assets, mostly for this class and for classes in finance, we just say, okay, your fixed assets. And that's gross fixed assets. And then you less the accumulated depreciation. In other words, the buildup of all the depreciations you have expensed to the income statement as time goes on. And then you get to your net fixed assets. And then finally, you add up your short-term and your long-term. Oh, I just wrote on damn glass. They are so going to kick my ass for that. Okay. You add up the short-term and the long-term. I'm sorry. The short-term and the long-term, and you get your total assets. And again, I'm being very summary, and that's because we do this summary in finance. It's not the end of the world if we clump things together a lot. Now we're going to move on here. Now this is one side of the balance sheet. The other side of the balance sheet is the liabilities and the owner's equity. There's almost no way to write this so that it's clear. I usually write the liabilities on one side and the owner's equity on the other side. That's not a very good idea, but there you are. Okay, now as far as liabilities go, You've got your short-term liabilities. Now, as far as short-term liabilities go, y'all have to be a little careful here. The first one, of course, the first one that I would care about is your accounts payable. What I owe, what I have recognized that I have paid, that I haven't paid. So if I get a $4,000 bill on January the 30th, my accounts payable goes up by $4,000. If I pay it on February the 15th, I pay all of it off then, my accounts payable goes down by $4,000, and, well, my accounts payable goes down by $4,000. So on January the 30th, my expenses, I recognize $4,000 worth of expenses, and I recognize a $4,000 increase in accounts payable. On February the 15th, I recognize a decrease of $4,000 in accounts payable and a decrease in cash of $4,000. There's one other one here I want to bring up. Now, you can get other ones, wages and salaries payable, and other things too, taxes payable. Now, you can see a bunch of them in here. One that I want you to keep an eye on is notes payable. And of course, and again, there could be other ones in here too. Now, the reason I bring this up is it really used to not be so important to me. But in recent years, and I got burned with this a couple of semesters ago. When we talk, we're interested in finance about things like debt and for ratio analysis and things like that, optimal capital structure. And so we always look at the long-term debt, the bonds of the corporation. And there was a corporation, and I won't mention its name, but its initials were Apple. I was just looking at the long-term debt, calculating the debt-to-equity ratio just every time, year over year, year over year. And suddenly I realized, wait a minute. Suddenly, just a couple of years ago, notes payable started going from a little dash, which is a zero, up and up. But debt was still staying pretty much zero. So my first impression was, well, this company is still remaining debt-free. Then I realized, no, this corporation actually isn't remaining debt-free, but what it is doing is it's incurring shorter-term debt than I would expect. So this is a corporation that actually is starting to leverage itself, except it's leveraging short, when I usually expect a company to leverage long. So I do now say, whenever I talk about debt, don't just look at the long-term debt. Go up here and add in any short-term debt, because I have now found more than a few examples of corporations that are not moving their long-term debt very much, but suddenly their short-term debt is increasing. And then on the other hand, you've got other corporations that are just diving out of short-term debt and piling into long-term debt. Of course, because they're expecting interest rates to go through the roof soon. But anyway, there's your total short-term liabilities right there. Then you have your long-term liabilities. And the one that's the most important to us is your long-term debt. Okay? Your long-term debt. And then you get your total of that, and you put your short-term and your long-term together, and you get your total liabilities. and grinding this down, we then do the owner's equity. Retained earnings at the beginning of the period. And then we say, okay, how much more came to the belongs to the shareholders? Minus how much did we give them right away? And so put those two together and we would get our change in retained earnings for the period. And then we add that one with that one. And I know I don't do this like accountants do at all. And we get our retained earnings for the end of the period. Retained earnings, end of the period. That's not the only thing, though, in the owner's equity section. There's something else in the owner's equity section. There is common stock and that can come in two pieces. This is a historical artifact, and it doesn't always apply anymore. The best way I can do this is to show you by an example. Suppose that I sold 1 million shares at $10 per share. And those common shares had a par value of $1 each. Historically, the way we have done it is this. I raised a total of $10 million. That $10 million comprises 1 million shares times $1. The par value of the issue is $1 million because I sold 1 million shares with each of those shares had a, and then the excess, and they'll use different words, is $9 million. It seems like an arcane system. But the way we would write the 10 million is not as 10 million. We would write it as 1 million, the par value of the issue. And then 9 million would be what we got in excess of par for the issue. Now here's where it gets a little complicated. $1 is not a very typical value. Usually you'll see a value of like a penny or a tenth of a cent or a hundredth of a cent. What's really strange to me even now is in modern times you've seen some companies that issued their stock with no par value, common stock with no par value. So there wouldn't even be this distinction between the par value and the amount that was brought in excess of par. Curious, were you shown the distinction between par value and excess of par in your accounting course? Did they mention that? Kind of looking like I've never heard of this. Some of you would have been dependent upon the accounting teacher. It was an old way of looking at ownership. Now, in the modern corporate sense, ownership, you're separated from you as an owner are separated from the bills of the corporation. The corporation is its own entity, has its own bills. The way I have seen it framed was that the par value concept was a legal representation of a small bit of owner liability. I'm not sure quite to this day, and I've talked with historical scholars on this, but apparently in the old days, they'd say, all right, par value is a penny a share. you own 1,000 shares. So you personally are on the hook for $10 of this company's bills. That was the, I guess that was the theory of what par value was about, but it has been there since forever. And so we still see to this day that distinction between par value and excess. In some sense, what the shareholders are on the hook for versus how much total they pay. I don't know if I even make sense of myself explaining that. But anyway. So what we have actually is owner's equity looks like this. Common stock at par. Common stock in excess of par. And then you have your retained earnings at the beginning of the period plus income, net income minus dividends represents retained earnings end of period. Change in retained earnings. And then from there we add that to this, and then you have retained earnings, end of period. And then you add these, the common stock pieces to the end, and you have your total owner's equity. Add that to the liabilities, and it should equal the assets. Now, let me walk away from that for a while, just briefly. Well, actually, more than briefly. Let me get to something a little more important to my way of thinking. What happens in reality? What happens really? We look at a balance sheet from one period to the next. I see that on that balance sheet, accounts receivable has fallen. In the reality of money, I've seen retained earnings fall from the last period to this period. Let's say that the retained earnings of the last period were $8,000. Accounts receivable. Jeez, Zoe. I'm sorry. I saw accounts receivable 2008 were $8,000. At the end of 2009, my accounts receivable were $6,000. Did I have $2,000 come to me or go away from me in this situation? To you. That's right. Just common sense, somebody paid a bill. And I got money in my pocket. That's all there is to it. So in other words, this went down. That means more money. That's a positive cash flow. Let's try another one. Suppose my inventory stood at $15,000 at the end of 2008 and stands at $18,000 at the end of 2009. Does that mean that I have more money? Money has come to me, or money has gone away from me? It went away. I had a net increase in inventory, which means that I spent money. So that's $3,000 out of my pocket. So I'm looking at something that tells me that here are two assets. Assets must always work the same way. In this case, an asset went up, That means less money to me. So that must be a drain, a negative cash flow. When assets go down, that means I've got money coming in. When assets go up, that means I spent money. Let's try something like this one. My notes payable were $50,000 at the end of 2008. They've gone up in 2009 to $60,000. Does that mean that I have lost $10,000 or gained $10,000? I've gained. I've had a net borrowing of more money. So I've got $10,000 in my pocket now that I didn't have before. So when a liability goes up, that is a positive cash flow. Try this one. My common stock the two of them added together. In 2008 was $110,000, and in 2009 I see that it is $130,000. Did money come to me or go away from me? $20,000. Did money come to me or go away from me? Well, it actually came to me. I must have sold $20,000 worth of stock because now I'm recognizing $20,000 of owners. I'm recognizing I've got $20,000 more of owners. So in other words, I sold $20,000 worth of stock. So that means that I got $20,000 in. So equity works just like liabilities. If it goes up, that means more money. Let me try this one on you. My depreciation expense for 2009 is $4,000. Is that money away from me or is that money to me? Say it. And actually, if I were looking at my net income, so let me try it this way. I see your point, son. I'm not cutting you down. You've got a good point. It's $24,000 of net income. I see that on the financial statement. On the income statement, net income is $24,000. So do I have $24,000 or do I have something other than $24,000? Knowing just what you've got there. Well, no, that was included in there. The net income included the depreciation expense. It's 28. Because the depreciation expense never happened. In reality, depreciation expense never happened. It's an accounting statement. What did happen sometime in the past was I bought something that was really expensive. That's when the money came out of my ass. But now, as I am doling out that $4,000 every year if it's straight line, that's not real money. So the net income is short $4,000 because I am saying on the net income that I paid $4,000 that I never paid. So you always have to add back in your depreciation expense if you are looking for cash flow. If I care about cash flow, then I have to add back in the depreciation expense because the depreciation expense never happened. You will not find in any checkbook of the corporation a check made out to depreciation. I always thought about changing my name to depreciation so I could get those checks. But there, you really never wrote a check to depreciation. You just put that on there because that's what we're supposed to do. Instead of recognizing a massive amount of money all at once as an expense, we simply recognize it period to period. From a financial point of view, let's say that I spent $40,000 three years ago. And I'm straight lining it, so that's $4,000 I get to recognize an expense every year. The reality of the situation in terms of cash flow is 3 years ago, I paid $40,000, real money. That's when I would recognize $40,000 in terms of real cash flow. Now, whenever I see on a financial statement $4,000, I add it right back in because I already dealt with the $40,000 when it happened in terms of finance. Let me take you along a little bit of a grinder here. I'm trying to think how I would want to frame this. Try this. Well, let me try this. Suppose that I retire a $500,000 bond. Now remember when I told you about corporate bonds, that as through the life of a bond, a corporate bond, you pay only the interest. Then all at once, at the end of the life of the bond, you pay off the face value. You retire the bond. So if I were to tell you I have retired a $500,000 bond, would that be an inflow of $500,000 or would that be an outflow of $500,000? Say it. Out. And it would not show up like that if you were just looking at accounting statements. You would see suddenly the notes, the bonds payable, the debt, long-term debt, would go down by $500,000. It would not show its real significance. Its real significance was that you just had $500,000 fly out of your ass in the corporation. You see, that's what I would care about as a financial analyst, is what came out actually from the corporation. If I look at the income statement, net income, it would have nowhere in it that $500,000. Nowhere in that net income statement would there be $500,000. You get the idea of it now, how significant this is. So I'm going to take you on a little bit of a journey here, if you will suffer with me. If I can figure out how to do this without hurting something I care about. Oh, I guess I have to turn the thing on. Whatever. There's some reason why this sucks. No. Boy, that worked. Oh, I'm sick of doing that. Here. Oh, the projector's on. Oh. On the front of this quiz that I'm giving you, which I want you to start here in class so I can walk through it with you, I've given you two different companies. These are not related. Those two columns are not related, for God's sake. They're just two different things for you to do. Now, this is just like a puzzle. Just do it like a puzzle, okay? You have to figure out one piece to get to another piece. So, for example, if I were to look at this, total stockholders' equity, December 30th, and total liabilities, excess of par. Okay. You have to figure out where to start. Once you got one number, then everything starts to fall into place. And it's just a more or less like a puzzle exercise, just to give you some exercise with accounting and all that kind of stuff. And like I said, we'll start it together, and I'll hand these around, and you can ask me questions. You can start to work on it. Now, on the other side, I'm going to ask you to try to figure out the answers to gross profit, operating income, that's EBIT, earnings before taxes, EBT, income tax net, from the information that I've given you up here. And again, just putting together this is just an income statement. And then the last part is you just put a plus or a minus on each of these to show me whether this is actually a cash inflow or a cash outflow. And it's common sense. It really is. Just think common sense and you'll get these just fine. So without further ado, I'm just going to hand this to you and let you just pound away at it here. And again, you may work in group on this. And just take enough time to get yourself started.
Thank you.
Hand one more. Take just one. Don't be greedy.
I'll be all right with that.
And then I'll just come around and walk with you with some of this. You gotta be kidding. Where are those Scantrons? Are they still somewhere in that room?
Oh.
Oh, I did. Where's this? They are? Oh, they're still handing around? Okay. That was not as efficient as I hoped it would be. Take just one, don't be greedy. Why don't you hand a block down that way? I have to get some more. Here you go. Hand a couple. It's kind of. Yeah, hold on to a couple and then try to hand them over there. Did I give you one? Nope. There you go. Another one. Try to get everyone. Folks are so scattered here. There you go. Let me get some over here real quick. I want you to at least get started on these together so we can all be a happy family. Or not. Okay, maybe not. Okay. I know those two guys are clustering next to the girl. No, man, we really need help. There you go. Kind of swirl those around if you would. There you go. Oh, I got another one. Yeah. Got one for you up here. Who doesn't have one? You need one more? Geez, I didn't count that very well. You got it? Now. Y'all got one? Okay. Okay, now the Scantrons. Where are those Scantrons? Are they still on that side? You got them? Okay. Now, here's what I want to just ask. Look on the first column. And if you could, if I could figure out. Yeah. Okay. Let me ask you, where do you start in the first column? Talk to me.
We don't know.
Okay. Good answer. Did everyone get Scantrons on this side? You got them? Is there anyone who's... Huh? Oh, yeah, you can keep them. Put them on the fridge. Mom will like to see it. This is all the people who are missing today. I ought to give all of you an extra point for being here. Well, that's true. Okay, now I want you to look at the first column here. I've got revenues of $200,000. I know my retained earnings January 1 were $300,000. I paid dividends of $70,000, and my retained earnings on December the 31st were $270,000. Now, what you would want to do right there is you say, now, wait a minute. I do know that if I have retained earnings beginning plus net income minus dividends will equal my retained earnings at the end. Right? Oh, yeah, yeah. Look at this. Do you have your retained earnings at the beginning? You have $300,000, right? Do I have my net income? No. Do I have my dividends? Yes, $70,000. And do I have my retained earnings at the end? 270. So I now know that 300,000 plus net income minus 70,000 equals 270,000. And it becomes just an algebra trick. You see how you do these? All you need to know is the right relationship between the among the numbers, and you can hammer out a number. So survey says... My ass. 300 minus 70. I so suck at arithmetic. 300,000 minus 70,000 is 230,000. You're right. Net income was 40,000. See, I knew that. I wanted to see if you could catch that. So I've got net income. So what can you find from there? Well, spank me hard and call me Doris. I don't want to. Oh. So revenues of $200,000 came down to a net income of $40,000. So that means that my expenses must have been $160,000. Do you see how you do it? You get what? Fine. There, are you happy now? See, they're all, like I said, it's sort of like a puzzle. And once you know the right relationship among some of the among the identities there, then all of a sudden things start to pop into place. So, but... Look at this. Commons. Almost hurt something I care about. See, common stock and capital in excess of par is $520,000. Now, okay, wait a minute. I know that total liabilities. Wait, I'm sorry. Common stock plus capital in excess of par plus retained earnings at the end of the period is my total stockholders' equity. Yes? So in other words, I know that retained earnings on December the 31st of 270 plus my common stock at par, that's common stock at par, plus capital in excess of par, December 31, 520, would have to add up to my total stockholders' equity. So 270 and 520, survey says? 790?
Yes.
Okay. Oh. So my total stockholders' equity is 790,000. My total liabilities are 140,000. I know that the total liabilities and stockholders' equity should match my total assets. Yes? So my total liabilities were 140,000. My total stockholders' equity was 790. So that means that the total of those two together is 930, right? Yeah. And that would have to be the same as the total assets, because total assets equal total liabilities plus total stockholders' equity. And then the other two are pretty much a joke, because current assets are 80,000, total assets are 930, so my non-current assets would have to be 850,000. And I know that my current liabilities are 40,000 and my total liabilities are 140,000, so my non-current liabilities would have to be 100,000. Do you see it? Okay, well, let me go back. My total liabilities and my total stockholders' equity add up to be the same as my total assets. So I know that 140,000 plus 790,000, which is 930,000, has to be my total assets line. So $930,000 is my total assets. If my current assets are 80,000, then the non-current assets would have to be 850,000 for the two to add up to 930,000. And my total liabilities are 140,000. My current liabilities are 40,000, so my non-current liabilities would have to be 100,000 for the two to add up to 140,000. So there you are. You got it? Now I'll leave the other one to you to work out. It'll work out. You won't use the same relationships. You'll have to. It'll be a little bit different puzzle, but it's the same idea. Once you get one, everything starts to fall into place quite easily. Now let me flip this over real quick. This one is just straight, you know, sales, by the way, is what I call revenue and sales are the same thing. But there you are. And then just put a plus or minus in each of these for number three, where I've given you something that has happened from one balance sheet to another to the next one. And you have to tell me whether that is an increase or a decrease in cash. Ah. Really? So how are we doing? Now I want you to turn that in on, that's due at the beginning of class on Tuesday. And the only other thing that I am going to do with respect to accounting per se is I'm going to show you how to calculate actual taxes using the real marginal tax rate tables, corporate tax tables that are currently in effect. But from there, we're pretty much done with accounting and we can move on to the wild world of finance itself. So as far as the lecture goes, that's all I have for you today. I thank you.